From the Associated Press, I'm Megan Crane, and this is Ground Game, a podcast about politics from the ground up. The headlines from Tuesday's election will be that voters returned control of the House of Representatives over to the Democrats, but gave Republicans a bigger majority in the Senate. They flipped at least seven governorships from Republican to Democratic, but also elected a number of candidates backed by President Trump. They elected a historically diverse group, but also candidates whose campaigns some considered racist. It's that diverse group we want to talk about today.
Tonight, right here in Colorado, we proved that no barrier should stand in the way of pursuing our dreams. We proved that we're an inclusive state that values every contribution, regardless of someone's sexual orientation or gender identity.
Tonight, New Mexico, you are sending one of the very first Native American women to
college. Assalamu alaikum.
When it comes to women of color candidates, folks don't just talk about a glass ceiling. What they describe is a concrete one. But you know what breaks through concrete? Seismic shifts.
We're joined by national writer for race and ethnicity, Erin Haynes Wack. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you've had your coffee. We're all a little tired today.
Definitely fueled by caffeine today.
Definitely. So let's talk about the firsts in this newly elected pool of representation.
Absolutely. So I think that what you saw was that race and gender really dominated Tuesday's midterm elections. You already had a record number of candidates of color and women running for office, and several of those people were victorious. And they also are going to be headed into office as trailblazers. That is from Congress to the state level. You had people who, you know, that voters in those places had never elected somebody who looked like them before.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the specifics. We'll have more than 100 women, both Democrats and Republicans, in the House of Representatives for the first time.
Yes, including certainly a record number of black women, more Hispanic women, Native American women.
Two Native Americans
never been in
time,
Congress,
right?
Before. You also had two Muslim women joining Congress for the first time. They go from having zero to two, in the upcoming Congress. But also states that are sending women to Congress for the first time. Iowa never had a woman in Congress before. Now they will have two. You have Tennessee sending Marsha Blackburn as the first senator from Tennessee who was a woman. We still don't know who is going to be the next senator from Arizona, but either way, that's going to be a woman.
Right.
And so, yes, there are going to be a lot of firsts in this next Congress.
So what do you think that means as far as both people feeling represented, but also what will that mean as far as governance?
Well, I think representation is definitely a big part of this conversation. You had a lot of voters saying that they wanted the chance to vote for somebody who not only looked like them, but who they felt would share their interests because they have similar lived experiences. And so that was a factor in a lot of these races, especially candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, was able to attract a diverse coalition of voters, especially young voters. She is going to be the youngest woman ever elected to Congress,
right,
when she takes office at 29.
Yeah.
Exactly. Geez, talk about...
what have I done with my life?
Exactly. Thinking, reevaluating your life choices. Young people are certainly a constituency that see themselves in her and feel like she maybe is somebody that's going to go to Congress with their interests in mind. But also what you saw were minority candidates who proved and kind of dismissed traditional expectations of electability, who were running in places where they weren't necessarily going to be representing a constituency that looked like them, right? And so a lot of times you have voters of color who are asked to vote for somebody who doesn't look like them, but candidates of color are often, told you should, only run in places where there are majority-minority constituencies. And this midterms proved that that is no longer a prerequisite for, considering a bid for office. I'm thinking about Lauren Underwood out of Illinois and also Johanna Hayes out of Connecticut.
Sure. So let's talk about also some minority candidates who apparently, or it's unclear at this point, but it seemed to have maybe not been successful. There was a lot of energy behind Stacey Abrams in Georgia. It looks like that race, they're going to try to get to a recount, but it might not even come to that. and Gillum in Florida's governor's bid. So how does that impact this feeling that candidates of color can represent a broad coalition?
Well, I think that what I've heard from the strategists and activists that I've spoken to, a lot of whom did a lot of work organizing during this midterm cycle to get more voters of color, young people, people who either don't vote regularly or who have never voted before, get those people engaged in this election. Even for candidates who fell short, they point to gains made nonetheless in some of those races, really kind of closing the gap in those races in places that were previously not thought of as particularly competitive. I'm thinking about Beto O'Rourke, who lost his bid to topple Senator Ted Cruz. You know, he lost by something like 200,000 votes. That is a margin that
in
maybe
Texas,
people did
right,
not
yeah.
think was possible in Texas. Andrew Gillum came within 55,000 votes of becoming Florida's first black governor. You know, Stacey Abrams, you know, the votes are still being counted there.
Right.
But, you know, that was a razor-thin race in Georgia, in a place where they've never had a black person or a woman serve as governor of that state. And so what the folks that do this kind of work are telling me is that they're encouraged even in defeat, because what they understand is that this is a long game for them and that they are gradually chipping away at some of kind of these old notions and frankly, some of the racism that can persist that prevents candidates of color from winning statewide and at the top of the ticket.
So what you're saying is, with an eye to 2020 or
2024,
yeah, that it's encouraging that a woman of color could have even come close in Georgia, basically.
Absolutely. And also that they're starting to see some inroads with coalition building with progressive whites, especially white women. Nationally, white women did increasingly vote Democratic, looking at the numbers. And so that obviously bodes well for them for 2020. They're thinking about 2016 and, you know, the 53% of white women who did not vote for Hillary Clinton, which came as a shock and surprise and disappointment, frankly, to a lot of those organizers and strategists. But they think that, you know, having those tough conversations and challenging their expectations about what is possible and trying to expand their understanding of what that is going to be effective. Maybe not necessarily last night, but perhaps it could pay off down the road.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the other races where they weren't necessarily candidates of color that were running, but where race played a role in those campaigns. What lesson can we take from those ads that were deemed racist by many people?
Well, I think that what we can take from it is that for at least some part of the electorate, a significant part of the electorate, racism still is an effective political strategy, right? I mean, I think that you saw President Donald Trump on the campaign trail at these rallies bringing up, you know, the migrant caravan as a scary specter for some voters. That resonated as dangerous, you know, people who are fleeing violence, characterizing them as dangerous and coming to the country to do us harm, referring to a lot of our urban centers is dangerous or corrupt. I'm thinking specifically of the race in Florida with Andrew Gillum, who is the mayor of Tallahassee, framing Tallahassee as a very dangerous place, even though violent crime is down in Florida's capital city, referring to or questioning the competence of somebody like Andrew Gillum or Stacey Abrams, who is a Yale Law School graduate. You know, people hear those things and, you know, they're coded appeals, but I think these were things that worked in 2016 for the president, and they're things that we saw working last night. So there's still some work to do on that front.
Okay. And in addition to race, we have all different kinds of diversity in this incoming class of congresspeople and other elected officials. For example, the LGBT community made a lot of advancements. Jared Polis was the first openly gay man elected governor of Colorado,
yes,
for example, and there are other candidates. What does that mean for diversity more broadly?
Again, I think it is speaking to the electability of folks and what that looks like. You know, you've got a changing electorate that is wanting to see itself more and more reflected in the politicians that they are choosing to represent them. And so for folks who are stepping up and stepping out and saying, you know, I want to run, they are finding support in these communities as these groups are continuing to diversify and grow.
So when you say support and electability, are those kinds of issues that they would have been dismissed as candidates, like no one would have given them outside money or that sort of thing because they were considered taboo, right, if they were gay or minority or what? When you say electability, what do you mean by that?
Just really the question of who is qualified to run or who can be elected by, you know, a broad coalition of folks in a particular community. You know, the thought was, to your point, that, oh, you know, people wouldn't support this candidate because they are gay. And it's like, well, that's not the only reason. Nobody's asking for that vote, you know, particularly because of any one part of their identity. I think that you've got people who are stepping up and saying that they want to serve, who are showing how they are qualified to do that and want that to be the focus, as opposed to questions of identity and how that may or may not resonate with folks personally.
Sure. I guess what I'm trying to get at is what electability means in practice, what it takes to get elected. You know, you need lots of money. You need support from lots of different people. So when we broaden that coalition, are you saying that outside groups, sort of kingmakers and influential people, are sort of broadening their perspective on what is electable?
I don't know that the kingmakers are broadening their perspective, but what I do think is, you know, that for, I think the common denominator, whether it's an LGBT candidate or a candidate of color or a woman, the ones who really broke through this cycle are the people who were seen as authentic.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that is something that really resonated with folks on the campaign trail. I'm thinking about Charisse Davids and Deb Haaland, in particular.
Those are the two Native American women,
yes,
right?
Yes. I mean, obviously, the Native American vote alone was not going to get them elected in their respective districts, but they were able to resonate with others because of their overall message.
And what does this younger, diverse coalition mean? Certainly, these advancements were largely on the Democratic side. What does that mean going forward for the Democratic Party if you look at their leadership, which is not particularly young and not particularly diverse, certainly after the end of Barack Obama's sort of time as the leader of the party? Are we talking about sort of a farm team, you know, sort of like a group of newcomers who are going to be eventually leading the party?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is definitely where the conversation is shifting, coming out of the midterm elections. You know, what to the extent that there was a blue wave, I think that candidates of color and women and young people and others are saying, you know, they created that wave. You know, it didn't just happen. And so with that being the case, they're now wondering how that is going to translate into leadership. There have been open questions about, you know, the future of Nancy Pelosi, if she's going to, in fact, be Speaker of the House. But even if she is, what do the other leadership positions look like? You know, a lot of these folks who are newly elected, obviously they don't have seniority, you know, but they do have a voice and they certainly do have the spotlight on them right now. And how do they use that to try to show the new face and possible direction of the party headed into 2020 and beyond?
Great. Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely. Get some sleep.
You too. I'm Megan Crane, and this is Ground Game. Our show is produced and edited in Washington by Kevin Benaise. We'll be back soon with reporting from around the country that explores how politics plays out on the ground. What issues do you want us to look into? What do you want to know more about? Let us know. You can reach us on Instagram at APGroundGame or on Twitter at the same handle. You can also use email groundgame@ap.org. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.